Please help me welcome our special guest speaker, Anne.
Thank you. My name is Anne, and I am an alcoholic. I kind of wanted to Facebook my girls' group, my women's group on Thursday nights, and say, "Hey, I'm speaking." And then I didn't want to seem like, "Oh, I'm bragging. Come hear me because I'm awesome." So then I didn't tell anybody, and I'm like, "What the hell? Where is everybody?" I'm just kidding. So I'm just playing. I've heard it being said before, alcoholics were egocentric with an inferiority complex. And what that means to me is, 1 minute I can feel so much better than even everybody else, and the next minute I feel like such an insecure mouse running around, you know. And it's always like it could just go, you know. I love this group. I avoided being a speaker of this group for many years. The 1600 Club was so intimidating to me. I mean, to have to speak here. And I feel like I'm family today. I feel like I belong. I feel comfortable here. I remember in early sobriety, I would judge people and I would oh shit, they're that sober and they're still that way, you know, or so-and-so relapsed, oh my God, what a loser, you know. And today it's not that way, because I can really see and feel what this alcoholism is all about, you know, that we're all on different roads and paths in our recovery, you know. You know, I might have learned something in this side, you know, kind of look at it like an oak tree, you know, a big oak tree with tons of branches. And it's I could see how I've grown so many ways over here, but I haven't even touched that side of the tree, you know. And I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I have a lot to learn, and I'm still learning, you know, which is so cool. You know, I'm willing to be teachable, because I know I don't have all the answers. Thank God. Thank God I know that. So what it was like, holy crap. Yeah, it wasn't good. I grew up the oldest of six kids. Grew up Catholic. I didn't get the memo that I was supposed to be the good example and the helper and all that stuff. I was just winging it, you know, and I was there for myself. And my sister, who is 1 year younger than me, she was more of the caregiver and watched and helped out with the kids and stuff. My whole life, I always felt like I didn't fit in. I always felt so insecure, so less than. I felt ugly. I just felt super uncomfortable. I guess really anxious growing up. I had a lot of phobias or fears. Not a lot, but I was afraid of fire. I was afraid of going to sleep at night. Just weird shit like that. You know, I didn't like going to church because I didn't pay attention, and, you know, my mom made us get dressed all perfect and all, you know, look good for her, and all go to church, all of us kids, and then we'd get our asses spanked after church for, you know, talking and this and that. So I didn't really put a lot into church, and I didn't really get a lot out of it. But I did get a seed, you know, a seed sown about my God, just a little seed, just like, okay, I get the concept there's a God, you know, but all the other stuff and the man rules and the politics and all that stuff, man's law, it just wasn't for me. So growing up, I was, my mom was super strict. My mom was really, really strict. And I was a little rebel without a cause. The first time I ran away, I was 6 years old. I just wasn't having all the rules, you know. And my mom thought if she beat the shit out of us that, you know, we would comply. We would do what she wants us to do. And she definitely put that terror into us. And she definitely, you know, hurt us physically. You know, my brother was taken away for a year. My sister, you know, my mom had to go to court twice. And she was in jail overnight for it, you know. And she didn't know how to raise us. You know, we were pretty rambunctious. I know I was. And, but I'm still, it's not my fault that she beat us. You know, I have to, see it for what it is today. So My dad, he was more passive and you know, yes, dear, yes, dear, yes, dear, just to get through. So we always kind of went for him, you know, went to him and asked him for help, you know, or asked him for favors because he was a softie and, you know, we could get our way. Never asked my mom. Like I said, I never felt like I fit in. And the first time I remember drinking, I was about 14 years old. My parents were away on a trip and we had some friend of a mom or somebody there watching us, an old lady. And we were upstairs in my room and I had one of those big jugs of red wine and big plastic tumbler cups. And I was with my sister and this girl Joelle and maybe somebody else. And we got lit. We were like so wasted. It felt so good. I loved it. We're like helping each other, like, while they're throwing up in the toilet, I love you, and all that wonderful shit, and I just thought it was the best. I just thought it was absolutely the best, and then of course she comes in, holy shit, the lady busted us or whatever, but I loved the effect produced by alcohol, loved it. I was still had a lot of problems. I'm sure some of it had to do with my dad hiding out at a hotel room because he didn't want to be subpoenaed for my mom's case. I remember kind of about 14-ish, I was just like, screw everybody, I don't care, and I'm going to do it my way, which I always felt that way anyways. I started smoking pot then, and drinking, and, my mom would say, I don't want you to have sex, and I don't want you to do drugs, blah, 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 blah. Well, I had to see what she was hiding, I had to, what are you hiding from me? It must be good, So I had to go do all those things that she suggested me not to do. I just remember being kind of miserable growing up and an outcast. At 12 years old, I had a spinal fusion. I had to wear a Milwaukee body brace from age 9 to 12, all the way down from here, all the way up to here. I looked like so stupid. And I'm supposed to be wearing this 23 hours a day, not taking it off. And it just hurt, and I got a blister on my hip. It was just the worst. And then about age 12, because my back wasn't getting good enough, I went and had a spinal fusion. And when I had the spinal fusion done, I had to wear a plaster Paris body cast for like 7 months. There are pictures out there that could blackmail me. I mean, it was not good. So I just really felt uncomfortable. I just need to say that because that's where I come from, where I'm learning in my recovery today that a lot of my reactions and decision-making and stuff comes from trauma and comes from having no steam whatsoever. So let's see, got expelled in school. I've been to a few different high schools. Finally just got a GED at the end. The end of my junior year of high school, we were ditching one time, and I met this guy at McDonald's with some of my friends that were there, and thought he was cute. Hooked up with him. I think my sister and I purposely got kicked out of the house so we'd have the summer free, and he just took me in and let me stay with him and his friends, and we just had a ball. I mean, we're doing, beer bongs, Mickey Big Mouth. I mean, it was just awesome. I got some homegrown for my birthday. It was what could I ask for? I couldn't ask for more, right? So in that time, the 3 weeks I was with him, he realized he's a total dork, and he didn't party like I did, and he was just like a booger on my finger. I couldn't get off. He was just like so annoying. And then I finally, I just left him. And went back home. I always knew going back home, I always had that back door of, I knew I always could go back home. Though I'd pay the price, get my ass beat, and having to deal with my mother, torture me forever. It was just, I always knew I had somewhere to go. My parents didn't know what the hell to do with me. They tried so many times. They put me in rehab when I was 16. I've been to a group homes. Been in a couple mental institutions. I'm grateful as crazy it was, they never gave up on me. You know, they never gave me a dollar. You know, they would never like enable me that way, but they always provided a way out for me. The hope of that maybe someday I can get sober, because they didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. Anyways, back to that guy in junior year of high school. So I go back home and come in to realize I just had a thought in my head. I think I'm pregnant. I mean, like, I just thought I was pregnant, like, right away. I just thought it wouldn't leave me. So I went to this place. It was Christian-based. I didn't care what. It was a free drug. It was a free pregnancy test. And I went in there, and they asked me all questions. You know, what would you do if you had this baby? Would you keep it? Would you abort it? Would you give it away? And I'm like, I don't know if I think I'd either give it away or keep it. And so then I went to the doctor's, got the test, came back there an hour later, and I opened up the envelope, and it said it had a check next to positive. And I swear to God, my brain went, oh, good, I'm positively not pregnant. Because there is, like, no way in hell. My mother's going to kick my ass, you know? I'm not supposed to be having sex. I'm supposed to be a good little Catholic girl, and holy crap, right? So I was scared to death. And it didn't stop me from partying and drinking and using, and I still did that. I remember even in when I was 3 months pregnant, I was down in Venice. Actually, okay, so, well, I smoked crack there, but then before that, you know, my parents basically washed their hands of me, which I don't blame them. I ended up running away to this guy's house, it wasn't the father, and lived with his family because his mom was 16 when she got on welfare, and she was willing to help me out because I knew my parents didn't want me around. And then in there, my parents literally dropped me off in the parking lot, and not a dime to my name. I was a total addicted smoker at the time, and it was the loneliest experience I've ever had. It was so lonely. I was so scared. I remember going toe-to-toe with this big black pregnant girl because I was on the phone trying to, like, be on the phone too much and like, acting all tough, like I'm gonna, you know, she's like, where are you? You're on the phone too much, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm in her face and everything, thinking I'm the shit, and I go in my room and cry. It sucked. So being in there after, I think, just a month, at 3 months pregnant, that guy let me come live with him and his parents, and that's when I learned the system. I learned how to get on welfare and food stamps and Medi-Cal and everything, and I'm grateful for it at the time. I really was. I was on it for a year and a half, and but it was so freaking degrading for me. It's how I felt. I was just like, I mean, at the time, I guess there's a credit card now you just put in a machine or whatever, but at the time you laid out the food stamps and they stamped them all out, and it was very humbling, very, I just, you know, continued to just pile on the shit that I already felt crap about myself, you know? And I definitely knew I wasn't meeting up to anyone's expectations, and definitely not my own. So anyways, I was with that guy for a year and a half, and he screwed my best friend and kissed the girl down the street or whatever. But he became an addiction. It was the weirdest thing. He became an addiction to where it's like I couldn't live with them and I couldn't live without him. It's like it was an insane place to be. So I went home finally, and I went back to home, and there's a little miracle there I want to share. He wouldn't let me visit my family. We lived in, where did we live? Oh, we lived in Santa Maria at the time. And my parents lived in Orange County. And he didn't want to pay for a plane ticket or whatever for me to go visit my family for the holidays. But after the holidays, he let me. So I went down there, and my mom, you know, she was just so devastated about my life and my lifestyle and have a little baby. I couldn't even clean my own room and all this stuff. And she saw, we were walking through Price Club, that's what Costco was called at the time, and she saw, Ann, your dad and I will totally help you, we'll help you with Monica, my daughter, we'll help you and go to school, this and that and everything. And my life was so miserable, but I couldn't imagine leaving that guy, right, because I was still getting high with him and everything else, right, and so finally I said, okay, I'm ready, you know. It's like, I don't know where it's coming from, but I was willing to try to get help. So the day I was supposed to fly back to Santa Maria, my dad just left. He's all, Ann, I'm going to take off for an hour. I'll be back. So I said, okay. And then right after that, the guy I was with called. And so he's like totally manipulating me. You need to come back. I can't, I could die. You know, whatever they say, right? And so I literally was changing my mind at the moment. I hung up and I was changing my mind at the moment. I was going to have my friend Andrea take me to the airport so I could fly back to Santa Maria. And right then, after I hung up on him, my dad walked back in. And my dad wasn't supposed to be back for an hour. And I said, Dad, here's the deal. You know, and it's, I really feel like God did for me what I could not do for myself. You know, like God gave me the strength by bringing my dad back in there to handle the situation. I'm like, you know, he wants me to come back. And then he rings again. And then my dad talks to him. Yeah, sure. And keep the van. And he hung up on him. And so we went back the week after to pick up all my shit. And he was nowhere to be found because he didn't want me to take the van back. So that was a crazy experience in itself, living with him and just the insanity. His father, I was 5 months pregnant at the time, and his father gets in bed with me, tries to, like, you know, he's all drunk and trying to, you know, it's just the insanity where I, you know, I feel like where I came from and where I went morally, with my values, with my lifestyle, everything. I was given everything I could. I went to, you know, private schools, lived in a wonderful area. You know, I had crazy ass parents, but at least, you know, I was given a chance. And then where I ended up being because of my alcohol and my other stuff, was living in Westminster, freaking on welfare, you know, with a boyfriend who I couldn't even trust, you know, who peed on me in bed because he was drunk. You know, it was just disgusting. You know, it was totally gross. So, bottom line, after being all the rehabs and stuff, my sister got arrested. She got arrested. She was drinking too, and other stuff. We were living in a motel room, and she stayed out. I went back home, and she got arrested on my parents' wedding anniversary. So my mom and I go to the women's jail to go pick her up, and I see her. She's telling the cops she doesn't want to leave with my mom. Like, she'd rather stay in jail. So we pick her up, and my mom heard about this rehab. It was like some intense place that one of our friends was sent to that her mom was talking to my mom and everything. So they sent her to this place. It's called Kids of LA. And it was in a warehouse back in Yorba Linda. And it was like very not, you know, it was very hidden. It was very hidden and different. And it wasn't like the old country clubs I've been in before. And so my sister was in there for a few weeks. And my brother and I went with my parents because they have this thing called, you know, family night on Monday and Friday nights where the family's supposed to come and support the drug addict and alcoholic in this rehab. And they help us out at the same time, whatever. So my daughter was 19 months at the time, and I went with my mom and my dad and my brother in the car. And I remember my mom, I don't know what song this is or whatever, but we were on the way over there, and she's all, "They're coming to take you away, ha-ha." And I'm like, what the fuck? So I'm like, I'm 20, right? So I don't have to do anything. So I'm like, but I'm looking at the street signs, knowing where I'm going, because this is not happening, you know? And so I went into this little room. It was a very small little room, very small. I mean, not even this big. And there's four chairs around in a circle. And I sit down, and there's a girl sitting next, you know, across from me. Then these two clinicals, like the big wigs or whatever, come in and have this packet of paperwork. And they're all, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they tell us about, you know, and we think you need to be in here. And I said, okay, I might need help, but I don't need your help, you know, and they kind of wore me down. I was in there for hours. I was dying for a cigarette. I really didn't want to be there. I had two jobs going on at the same time. I spray people with perfume in the malls, and I worked at Rusty Pelican as a hostess. And, but the real thing is, the truth about it is I would nurse my daughter to sleep every night and sneak out of the room so I can go party. That's how it was. And before that, another thing that was pretty intense in my back in the day is when I used to hang out with this girl named Andrea all the time, and she was in a severe car accident, so she got like $1 million. So she had a nice BMW, and she, you know, we'd go score all the time, and, you know, just get high all the time. And one time we snuck into this community pool in her neighborhood that she didn't belong to, went over the fences or whatever. I had my daughter year and a half old at the time. And I was messing around, you know, totally high, messing around with this guy in the jacuzzi. And she was there talking to her guy or whatever, and we're all high. And I remember asking my friend Andrea to watch Monica, who was in the jacuzzi with her diaper, wet diaper, you know, hanging on to the sides or whatever. And I remember, because my back was to her, and I remember looking and going, or hearing my friend go, because Monica went under, and she was okay, thank God. But when I remember back to that, it still hurts. That's where it took me, you know? That's where it took me, where I love my kid more than anything in this world, but I did not have the capability of taking care of her because of this fucking disease. I didn't. And so when they were trying to get me in that rehab and they were wearing me down for a few hours, I said, okay, I'll do it for a cigarette. You can give me a cigarette. So let me smoke 3 cigarettes. And that was like the last cigarette for almost a year. And so I did have motivation in wanting to be sober. I wanted to learn how to be a good mom. I wanted to learn how to be a good person that I knew was in there. All the shit, because my lifestyle and my drinking and using was not showing the wonderful qualities, man, you know? So my sister was in there, and then I was in there, and I don't know, a couple months later, my brother ended up being in there. It was insane. It was crazy. Let me describe this rehab. So when I first went in, we went to the restroom. I had to take all my clothes off. I had to wipe quail. It's for scabies. I didn't have scabies, but I had to wipe all this shit all over my body, wash my makeup off, put a ponytail in. So I had these baggy ass jeans and a sweatshirt. And they took me by the belt loop. And they brought me to the back of the room, and they walked me down the middle aisle, and they turned me around, and they said, "This is Anne. She's, she drinks. She's done PCP. She's done cocaine. She's done speed. She's done marijuana. She, you know, listed all the shit I did." And everyone goes, "Hi, Anne." And then they sat my ass right there, and I was not allowed to speak, move, or anything for 2 weeks. And after that, I was allowed to participate in conversations in the group. And it was intense. I mean, it was just insane. We couldn't even lean back in our chairs. We had to sit up with our hands on our knees. And after a couple weeks, I earned you know, when I told you about like my family, like on Monday and Friday nights, they would come and they'd be a huge room and they'd be on the other side. And like when I'd stand up on my side, it was my turn, my family would stand up and my family would say, "And like specifically my sister, my brother, my mom and my dad, whoever else was left out there. And I remember the time that you blah, 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 blah." And she could even be talking about, she could mistake me for my sister. And I couldn't say a damn thing, you know, but it's just like, I'd say, "Thank you, Mom. Thank you, Dad." It was just crazy. And then we sat down and we'd have these huge many hour things way into the night, on Mondays and Fridays. And, finally, I got in there in October, and it was around Christmas time, and I would try it the whole week if you behaved yourself, basically. They felt you earned it, they would allow you to belt loop you, to take you to the other side of the room at some point of this meeting, sit with your family, and all you were doing was blurting out specifically bad things you did when you were a kid relating to drugs and alcohol, and make amends. It was like a amends process. And and I couldn't say anything, you know. I couldn't, that's all I could do, is just nothing else. "Hi, how you doing?" Anything like that. They told me when I first got in there that my daughter Monica, at age 19 months, was going to be able to come to those meetings. The first meeting I earned to go over talk to the family, Monica wasn't there. I said, "Where's Monica?" And they said, "Oh, they're not going to let her come." Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, you know. I was so pissed. And I was trapped. I couldn't leave. Even at 20 years old, there was a chain of command. Like, I had to know this chain of command to ask who, whatever, blah, 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 to get out of there. It ended up being a fucking cult. Literally. It was a cult. Didn't know it. My parents were just excited as hell because they saw Anne with no makeup on, sitting there nice and shiny, not being able to talk shit from the other side of the room, you know, and not being able to get out and, you know, destroy my life. I was in there almost a year. My sister was in there almost a year. My brother was in there almost a year. And at one point, I think the place went bankrupt, but this affiliation of the group took over, and it was so much more laxed. I mean, I became so rigid there that I'm like, my brain became so brainwashed. I couldn't even think straight. But I'll tell you what it did do for me is, from my head to my heart, in that time being in there, I absolutely realized and believed I am an alcoholic and a drug addict. My life is totally fucking unmanageable, and I want help. So that's what it did for me. So I got the motivation and the willingness to work on myself. And that mostly was to be with my kid. You know, I wanted to be able to be that good mom that I was hoping to be. And so finally my brother AWOL'd actually, and then we were pulled out. Otherwise we'd probably be in there another year or something. But I started going to meetings, AA meetings afterwards, and I didn't wear makeup for a little while, and I didn't listen to druggy music for a little while, and I wrote these moral inventories every night, because that's what they did in this program, right? And then slowly got back into reality and everything. And you know, I have so much to tell you about since then. You know, I married a guy that was in that rehab who ended up molesting my daughter. I divorced him when she was 9, and, you know, I allowed him to be her dad still, and come to find out from age 11 to 13 that he was molesting her, he was giving her drugs, and he was taking advantage of my daughter. And, you know, if there weren't a time to drink or use over that, I don't know what would be, you know. I remember Jim came with me and went to court because it, you know, became a case and everything. I found out, and district attorney and all that stuff is in San Luis Obispo. And Jim came with me once when we were talking to the district attorney, and I remember they were saying, so what would you like to come out of this? And I said, well, I know he's probably not going to get life, but, you know, like 20, 25 years would be good. And and then the DA said, you know, some people, sometimes they only get like a year in county. And at that moment, it's like, this is why people don't fucking tell people. You know, this is why this shit is not, you know, told, because there's no support. And I remember in the San Luis courthouse, which I'm sure some of you know, you kind of have to like go outside and walk to your car. It's not like, you know what I mean? And I remember walking down the street after hearing that and seeing some neon lights. Like, I don't know if it's a bar or whatever, but I saw neon lights, and automatically I thought to myself, this would be a perfect excuse to go get drunk. And I'm not a Bible thumper. I am a Christian. But what came to me was, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. And I thought, you know, that doesn't mean anything to me, right? You know, this guy needs to be in jail with Bubba, screwed in every orifice, and handled, right? And but what I'm telling you is what has given me the strength to move forward and not being having this poison in me, this hate and wrath in me, is to know and really believe that God's got it. God's got him. God's going to take care of him. And what's been wonderful is I've been sober and available for my daughter to listen to her. She'd say, Mom, I got to talk about this. I'm like, okay, what? You know, it's like it really was hard for me to hear what happened with her and what happened. And it was just devastating, but I was able to be there for her. I even had guilt about it because I felt like I failed as a mom. I didn't know anything about what was going on, but I felt like I failed. I'm there to protect her. You know, in sobriety, this shit shouldn't happen. You know, I'm sober. You know, life should be perfect. And that happened. So that was really difficult. I went through divorce. I went through that. And at 3.5 years sober, I suffered massive, massive panic attacks to the point where I didn't even leave the house. I was like crippled by anxiety. And that's where my faith in my higher power came. I had a belief, but I had no faith. I had no trust. And I didn't know what to do to get out of this insanity that I was feeling. You know, I had nothing to cover up my anxiety and the torture I felt. I mean, I remember being on the floor in a ball, just like scared to death, feeling so hopeless. And it was just torturous. And I got help. I got on some non-narcotic medication to stabilize my stabilize my crazy ass brain to help me not have anxiety attacks all the time. But then there was also my part, the footwork, which was going to meetings, sharing honestly, crying about my fear. I don't care how many times I had to cry. I had to save my ass, not my face. and share have all the fear that I had and I was getting through. And then what happens, my sister said, Ann, you should go to beauty college at 25. It says 25. And I said, it was like the light went on. It's like, yes, that's exactly what I want to do, you know? So I went to beauty college, but I was still suffering that shortness of breath from my anxiety attacks. And like being away from the house for 8 hours was like a seriously hard thing to do. And I just put one foot in front of the other, and I went through beauty college, which to some, you know, but to me, it was a huge feat. And I had shortness of breath. And another little mini miracle is we had this, you know, the state board exam, right? Well, they were teaching us about the state board exam. So this lady came for a speaker, and she was talking about how to get ready for the test and how they go down and get your kit and has all the stuff you need for the test when you're putting curlers in people's hair and this and that. And she says, a lot of women, you know, get shortness of breath. I'm like, what? And they say, and she taught us how to breathe. She says, you know, you breathe through your nose and out through your mouth. And to do that two or three times, and I was able to catch my breath. That breath that I thought I was never going to catch and run around flailing my arms in the middle of nowhere because I'm fucking crazy and I don't know what to do. And so little bits of pieces of hope, God doing for me what I could not do for myself, and me putting one foot in front of the other, sober. I passed my state board test, and I've been a hairdresser since I was 25 years old. I absolutely love what I do. Love it, love it, love it. I love color. I'm good at it. People feel good when they're leaving, you know, that I made them look pretty and fun. And I get to bullshit with people all day, you know. And it's just like, you know, catch up the next time I see them. It just works for me, because before that, I would last like 6 months in a job and I just get so bored out of my mind, so irritable that I had to get another job. I just couldn't stay in a job. So, you know, I've been sober for a while. I've been sober since I was 20. I'm 51 now. I'll have 31 next month, 31 years next month on the 22nd of October. And how I've done it is I've kept coming to meetings. I've kept sharing honestly where I'm at, when I'm crazy, when I don't know what to do. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a book we have. It's a little blue book over here. And we don't do it alone. You know, it's really highly suggested to get a sponsor, which is someone who you've seen in meetings, who have worked the steps, and ask them for help, preferably men with men, women with women, and so we don't get too distracted. And you know, just really focus on the steps and recovery. And I've worked the steps. I believe I'm absolutely powerless over alcohol and drugs, and my life is unmanageable. At 4.5 years sober, when my ex-husband and I were still together, and I thought we were going to live happily ever after and recover together, decided he wasn't an alcoholic or an addict and started using. And he's talking stories about me. He's driving with one eye, you know, and just all fucked up and shit. And I was scared shitless for him, for us, our relationship. But, you know, to be honest, there was a part of me that was jealous, you know. How come he can go? How come he can drink and I can't, you know? And I just had to be honest about that in my 4 years recovery, that I started having, like, doubt. Like, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, you know. I was a total fucking rip of a kid, totally rebellious, you know, behavior problems or whatever. Maybe I would, you know, after college, you know, and every, you know, all these college kids, they straighten up after college and become these super awesome people. Maybe that would have been for me, you know. And so it was really becoming an obsessive thinking at 4.5 years sober that I might not be an alcoholic. And there's a lady named Barbara Castleman, I think it was, in the program. She was one of the old timers. And she said, how bad was it really? You know, why don't you write a drunkalog? And so I had to kind of really just get honest with myself and write, how bad was it really? It was really fucking bad. I felt like shit when I drank. The whole lifestyle was, I felt like dead in my soul, like black in my soul. I went against everything I believed in and I hated myself. So it was bad enough. Bottom line is what I came to is it was bad enough. And there was one time, too, I was in a grocery store and I started to have this session. I saw some Coors Light, which I hated Coors. And I thought, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, you know? And it's like I started obsessing about wanting to drink again and I just didn't drink no matter what. I came to meetings and I shared honestly, I fucking feel like drinking. You know, like I say, better save my ass than my face. And that's what I've been willing to do all these years in sobriety is try to be as honest as I possibly know to be. You know, we're as sick as our secrets, they say. And so for me, I was able to get honest with my sponsor, share my fourth and my fifth step with my sponsor. And that's, hopefully you guys get a sponsor and get this big book, because that way you'll learn how to work the steps. And that's what saved my ass. You know, this fellowship is awesome because we all connect. We all kind of like feel, identify with each other in certain ways that we are blown away with because we thought no one thinks or feels the way I do. And then the nitty gritty is the steps, which is really diving into, and it says more will be revealed, you know? And so what I simply thought, I just wanted to drink alcohol to have fun and party and feel good. There was a lot more into it than that. And that's what I've been delving in the last couple of years is I kind of, you know, I went through that panic disorder in the early sobriety, and then I kind of got adjusted to being sober and not feeling so anxious. And then I started gambling a lot, and I started eating a lot, and I started shopping too much. And I'm medicating in all these different ways in sobriety, you know. And I still have that feel good mentality. I want to feel good. I want to feel safe because I didn't feel safe when I was a kid. I want to just be able to do what I want to do because I never had that freedom before in at my home growing up in that rehab. And so I think I have like these a lot of, you know, PTSD symptoms of this trauma from when I was a kid. And so me as my, you know, don't tell me what to do. You know, I'm a grown woman. I make my own money. You know, I can do whatever the hell I want. I can spend my money the way I want. And that was kind of my attitude, is coming from this rebellious kid, you know, this rebellious kid mentality where don't fucking tell me what to do. But where it's gotten me is to the point where I'm disgusted by myself again. I'm like, I've gotten to the point where I'm wasting so much money at this casino because I like to check out for like 5 hours at a time. I'm only gonna spend $200. I'll bring $200 with me. No, I'm not gonna go to the ATM. I fucking go to the ATM, and I have to pay $350 charge $350 to get more money out. So I might as well get another $200. It's fucking insane, okay? As some of us might know, you know, but it come to the point for me that it was not okay anymore. And so I've been seeking outside help. I go to a therapist who is in the program. She totally identifies with the crazy, and she's been willing to help me, even though for months and maybe even years, I was still not able to give up the ghost. I still went to the casino. But had that want, you know, that need. And I feel like a fucking newcomer, you know, that wanting to not drink, but still drinking, you know, so I could identify with the new people and remember just how it was. And so I've realized about that about myself in the last few years that some of my behaviors are not okay anymore. And so I've been making some big changes in my life. I don't go to the casino anymore. I go to therapy. I even go to church. I go to a Baptist church. I remember there was a Good News Club when I was a kid. It was just like you go to the lady's house on the corner, and they had candy and cookies, and they did Bible studies with some cool stories about the Bible, and I really dug it. And then coming to find out it's the Baptist that did it, I might try this. You know, it took me 9 years in sobriety to even crack open the door of willingness to go back to church. But it was a church that I needed to find where I felt fed. This is just my story. I'm not saying everyone needs to go to church. I'm just saying this is my story. And this is where God has blessed me so much, where I really believe God is in me. You know, I believe God has given me his spirit to be able to have the strength to do what I need to do by continuing to go to meetings, continuing to be honest, continue to save my ass, not my face, because sometimes I'm like, what the fuck? If I told people at 31 years of sobriety how crazy I feel right now, they'd be like, why should I be sober? And but the point is I'm willing. You know, I'm totally willing to continue to work on myself. A year ago, October 1st last year, Darren and I, my bucket list, on just to share some fun things in recovery, my bucket list was to go to Venice, Italy. It was just a dream, you know, just a dream that would never happen, I'm sure, especially after that anxiety disorder. I mean, I couldn't even freaking drive across the street, let alone fly on a plane, go anywhere like that. But I really, really wanted to do it. And thank God the program and outside help has given me the ability to put one foot in front of the other. And it was a big deal for me. It really was. And Darren and I, we flew to Rome, and we went to the Vatican, and we saw the Sistine Chapel, And we went over to Trevi Fountain, which is this beautiful marble fountain. And but we didn't have much time. We had to get on a ship, and we went to a ship. I'm not bragging. What I'm telling you is, the reason I'm telling you this is because this is the shit we get sober for, isn't it? This is, we want to feel good. We want to feel, I know I want to be able to reap the benefits of being sober. So it just shocks me that God gave me the ability and the gift, the grace to do this. So we went to Naples, Italy, and first stop, and we went to this island called Capri. And there's this place called the Blue Grotto, and it's like you go into these caves in these small little boats. You even have to kind of duck under when they take you in. I didn't go on it because the tide was too high, but that's why the main reason I went. But we toured this island, and it was absolutely beautiful, breathtaking. I mean, we went, and at the top of this island, there was even like kind of like a ski lift, a one-person ski lift. We went up to the top, and the views from there were just, it was heaven. It was so beautiful. You see way the hell down there and the ocean and everything. It was just so pretty. And then we went to Santorini, Greece, and that was always just a dream. You know, I never thought I'd go to Santorini. Everything's all white and blue tops, and it's just so beautiful. And Darren and I were able to experience that together. We ended up going to 7 different places in Greece. You know, it was wonderful. And then at the last, the ship dropped us off and ended in Venice, Italy. And we spent 3 nights there and on the Grand Canal. It's like Italy, Venice, I don't know if you guys know, I didn't know long ago, but everything is on stilts. There's like a million stilts. It's like in the water. There's no cars. You can't drive through there or anything. It's all done by boat. Even like the trash, the ambulance, everything's done by boat. And there's like a big canal in between, you know, this island sort of. And we had a hotel room right there, and then we were right by the bridge. There's a famous bridge right there, and went to San Marco Square and went to the palace, and it's just like this is what gives me such gratitude to be able to do this with my husband, who I met here in recovery. I thought he was a nice guy, you know, that's it. And He came to the shop one time when I worked at Penny Salon and asked, you know, want a haircut or whatever, and then he sent me flowers at work, and it's in the little card, it was printed on it, "I adore you," and then he wrote, "I hope you have as beautiful day as you are," and I thought, oh, that's so nice, but I'm so not interested, so, but the cool thing was, I told him, you know, "I'm not interested. I think you're a great guy. Let's be friends." And what the difference in how I react, you know, how I acted when I was out there, fucking who cares? You know what I mean? I picked the worst people in the world. And with Darren, we became friends first. We had a lot in common. I wanted to hang out with him all the time. And then I started thinking, you know, I'm not going to be okay if he starts dating somebody else. You know, it's like the tension will be off me, and I really, really like this guy. So we slowly worked on a recovery, a relationship in recovery. And it took us 9 years before we got married, and we just been married 14 years. And it's been a wonderful experience in recovery, you know, to have someone to share with who's in the same, you know, wanting recovery you know, that together, and it's so wonderful that we have that. My mom, who was a big oil and water thing with me for so many years, I couldn't stand her. I had the thought of stabbing her one time when I was a kid. I was glad she got in jail. You know, she was so critical of me, so condemning of me. And I remember even flinching around her when she'd come by for no reason. I'm doing dishes and she raises something. I'm like, you know, it was fucked up, okay? Today, working those steps, I'll tell you what. I wrote resentments. We write our resentments about everyone we hate and all this shit. You'll get more thorough with your sponsor. But anyway, she was like 2 pages in my 4th step of just, I resent my mother for the time that she did this. And, you know, she beat me and it wasn't even my fault or whatever. All the shit that I couldn't stand my mom for, right? And then the process of the 5th step and understanding, you know, what my part is and, you know, the change in my perception of it. It was really cool because what happened was this woman who was like up there, authority figure and better than, bigger than, all this stuff, she, and visually in my mind, what happened is when I shared all that poison out and saw, I was able to see my mom come off this pedestal in my mind, visually, come off this pedestal and stand right before me as a woman who's just older than me, who just did the best she could with what she had, because she is sick too, you know? So if I can still be in that spiritual condition where I can remember that and not react off the shit that, that, you know, when she pokes me, and if I don't, you know, react and call her a bitch or run away or whatever, I'm doing good. And so it's a trip too, because I know it's 8 o'clock. It's a trip too, because right before Darren and I went, we bought a new place, and Darren was fixing it up and everything, and a lot of other stuff happened where my best friend died and at 52, and so I was going through a lot, and my dad, I just happened to call my dad because I heard my brother was buying their house, and they told me that they were going on vacation, they're going to go on a cruise, and I'm like, can I come? And my schedule's kind of flexible, so I said, if I can go less than a couple grand, I so want to go with you guys. Didn't really know. He saw, I think we're going to the Aruba and Panama Canal or whatever. So I went with them in their room with them, my parents, for on a 10-day cruise, and 10 or 12 days. And it was awesome. It was awesome. I stayed in the room. I was in the little pull-out bed there in that squishy little room. And I saw my mom. And what's cool is my therapist, she says, Anne, you don't have to change her. You don't have to be right about things. You don't have to correct her. Just observe. Just observe. So that's the mentality I went in with, because I really wanted to enjoy this trip. And I curled her hair at night before dinner, and we enjoyed time together, went to the spa together, and it was such a blessing. I think like a healing blessing for like all of us. And in the meantime, I was able to go to the Bahamas with them, and to Aruba and Curacao and Costa Rica, and I held a sloth in Costa Rica and went and did through the Panama Canal. One thing really quick to tell you about the Panama Canal. So when we were going through the Panama Canal, I didn't really know much about it. It was like, you have to look at history or read about it. But so there's this huge locks going through these mountains to be able to get to the other side, because North America and South America are just a little strip, right? So they built these locks where a huge cruise ship goes into this, and then they close the door, they hydraulically fill it with water, open it, and it takes you through to the next one, close it, lift it up, and it takes you that way through this canal. It's so cool. So my dad and I were up on the balcony, and we're taking pictures and looking at things in the lock, watching a little train take us up and stuff, and he's like, you want to go to breakfast? So I said, okay, I want to go breakfast. So we went down to the main dining room, which is like the nice one with the crystal glasses and stuff. And we're sitting by the window. And there's a cement wall right there. I mean, just, you know, right there. And so, but it was so cool because we're sitting by the window and we saw the boat slowly go up, and we saw the sky and everything. And so I'm looking out there and everything. There's this guy with a hard hat, you know, that works on out there and stuff. And I took my crystal glass of water, and I went like this to him. And then he reaches into his bag, and he pulls out his thermos, and we did cheers. I felt like I like made contact with an alien. It was the coolest thing in the world. So anyways, just to be able to experience these awesome gifts in recovery is worth all the shitty times I feel. It's worth all the crazy stuff I feel sometimes, because now I know what to do with the crazy. You know, I know what to do with the crazy, so I don't have to drink or use. And thank God for the solution I have. And I have to be reminded. That's why I keep coming back all these years later, because I forget. I forget surrender. I forget pray. I forget let go, let God. You know, I forget these things that were taught so easily. And so I have to be reminded and just remember the hope, because I have found and seen so many people in these rooms change their lives. And that in itself is such a gift. So I continue to work on me because I want what I have. And I'm just really grateful for you guys. Sorry I took over. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for sharing your message of recovery with us. Everybody, let's thank Anne again.